It's 808 on WCCO. I am Laura Oakes. Our Mr. Denny that we love so much has retired. Thank you so much for tuning in. We miss him just as much as you do, and I'm hoping to keep his easy breezy style going and hope that you will all stay along with me. It is time for Smart Gardens, as you know, and today our wonderful expert from the University of Minnesota Extension Service is Laura Irish Hansen. Good morning, Laura.
Oh, good morning, Laura. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. And I have to say, I heard you last week when you called in to Denny's final show, and I just was so struck by your kind words and your message to him and just what he and your being on this show has meant to you. So thanks so much for doing that. I'm glad I get to meet you now.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad that, they let me even call in. I didn't know if I would be allowed to cut in with all the callers last week.
Of course. Of course. We have a lot of questions already lined up. And before we head to the text line, I just want to say, and, you know, my goal on this show and some of the others on Saturday mornings is to hopefully encourage people to call in instead of text in, especially if your question is kind of a long, involved one. It's kind of difficult to read it on the text stream. Things show up in kind of a backwards order. So I'm going to ask the two people who have sent in questions regarding asparagus to please call us, because it's just so much easier to understand your question if you can ask it yourself. So it's the same number as the text line, 651-461-9226. You asparagus people, give us a call, please, and Laura will do her best to answer your question. We do have a cherry pit related question, Laura, and now let me see if I can find it here. I have collected some cherry pits this spring from a friend's tree. How do I start them, and should I keep them in a pot the first winter? What do you think?
Yeah, so with those cherries, I'm curious where this caller is coming in from, because cherries aren't ready yet here in Minnesota, or Texter, sorry. But for cherries, you can just germinate them pretty easily, actually. You just put them in a seed starting mix or a slightly finer potting mix to get them to germinate. It is best, you can try to put them right out at the end of this season, not the end, but near the end of summer. But you're going to really want to, if you do that, protect them from critters, because critters really love cherries. So I would keep it in a pot if you could. It's a little challenging, though, because they do need to go through like a dormancy type period. And thankfully, they don't grow very big that first year. So when you have them in the pot, you can stick them in a fridge. Now, if you have limited fridge space, that might be a little challenging, but it is an option.
Okay, good. On to some weed talk. Here's another texter. I have an invasion of common soapwort, or maybe soapwort. It is choking out my perennials. What is the best process to get rid of them without damaging my other flowers?
Yeah, so it's typically, we were going to say we recommend manual removal. So hand weeding as best as you can, getting in there, trying to dig up as much of the underground structure. So think of like the roots of that plant. If you can, try to get every piece. It's a little challenging to do that sometimes if they're tangled up in the roots of some of your perennial plants. But just working on it slowly, time, like over time, is the best thing you can do. Herbicide, I wouldn't recommend it necessarily, just because it sounds like they're pretty embedded with your other herbaceous plants.
Okay. We have a couple of questions regarding pests already this time of the year, and I'm wondering, is there any kind of a standard way to prevent the beetles or the things that are eating holes in our leaves of our plants, or anything that is kind of organic and not a chemical that a dog could get into? Or, you know, is there a way to just kind of all purpose get rid of the pests, or is everything individual?
If somebody found some way to, it's like a silver bullet, they'd be making a lot of money, but there is no silver bullet for that, because insects have different life cycles, and when they're emerging, when they're active, when they're adults versus when they're larvae, if they're something like that has a caterpillar or a larval stage. And so, yeah, there's no surefire way to keep all the different insects away. And a lot of these insects, some of them are native, and so they are here, they're present. We're going to see them year after year. Some of them are non-native insects that we do want to try to control. But the best thing you can do is just be in your garden, be in your yard, and just pay attention. And the sooner you can see that there is some type of damage, the easier it is to then examine that plant or that space and see what's going on. I always, always recommend don't just look at the top side of the plants. Get down on your hands and knees if you can, get as low as you can, and flip and look at the underside of leaves, look at where leaves attach to the stems, because sometimes these insects are going to be pretty small or trying to hide, right, in essence. So we want to make sure that we properly ID whatever that pest is before we try any type of treatment, including manual removal, because you might accidentally be removing, for instance, like swallowtail larvae from your dill, parsley, carrot plants. And that is a beautiful native butterfly, but some people mistake it because as a bad pest, because it does do a pretty quick work on those plants.
Right.
So proper ID is really key.
Okay. Now, I know that some of your expertise has to do with resiliency with our plants and with our landscape. And I also see that the Arboretum has kind of a special couple of field days coming up that addresses resilient landscape horticulture field days on June 8th and 9th. Talking a little bit about some of these challenges, jumping worms, Japanese beetles, other stuff like that affect our plants' health. And that is kind of, that's your jam. So what could people learn from a workshop like this? And it feels a little bit over my head, but maybe it's not. Like, is this something that anybody could grasp on how to control these pests?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up. So I'm actually one of the ones spearheading this field day.
I thought so.
It is for the resilient. Yeah. And so I'm working with a couple of the researchers, the professors on the St. Paul campus, who do landscape horticulture work specifically. And so they're researchers, graduate students, they're all actually going to be tabling and talking about things that homeowners specifically can do. If you want to look at jumping worms learn about jumping worms, excuse me, if you want to learn about a new disease that is impacting some of our junipers and crab apples, there's black walnut information that'll be going on. There's so many cool parts. And the cool thing is that it's from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., both Monday and Tuesday. It's the same thing. So once you get to the Arboretum, it's open to anybody to just walk in and learn and talk to the researchers. And they have great handouts that will be available for these various topics. It's just really fun. And there's also, this is the thing I get most excited about. There are private peony and weigela research plots that are not open to the public typically. And there is guided tours. It's $15 after you get into the Arboretum. And we do need pre-registration for that. But you get to see about 500 peonies in peak bloom and the similar number of weigela. And weigela are spring flowering shrub, for those who don't know.
Yeah.
And so absolutely wonderful. You get to talk to our woody landscape plant breeder who does the weigela breeding now, and also our professor who does resilient landscape work. And so if you're curious about this and you want more information, it is on our extension site. That's extension.umn.edu. And if you go to the courses / events tab right at the top, click on that. I always just type in horticulture for my search and it pops right up. So
excellent.
Yeah, come check it out. Come say hi. I will be there both days.
Wonderful. And we don't have too many days left for our peonies this year. So get out and see these special ones while you can. I don't think I need to know anything about jumping worms, though, Laura. And what I don't even want to ask you what a jumping worm is. Isn't just a worm kind of enough said about just being a worm? Do they have to jump?
So jumping worms, well, for those who don't know, there are no native worms to Minnesota.
Mm.
So here's one of your fun facts for the day.
Interesting.
So jumping worms, however, they are really, really pretty aggressive in the top couple inches of our soil. They go through organic matter really fast. And so pretty detrimental, particularly in our natural areas and forested areas in the the upper Midwest, but particularly for us in Minnesota. And so jumping worms have been here for quite a few years, actually, but they're just slowly spreading across the state.
Let's now, talk about... Go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say, one of the ways you can tell them the difference is once we get later in the summer, if you encounter a jumping worm and you get it, you know, you touch it or it's you get it on top of the soil, it'll be wriggling around really fast, like really fast. And it's one of, I don't want to tell you all to YouTube it or, sorry, look up your favorite video streaming for that. But yeah, the videos are kind of nightmarish.
Oh, I think I'll take your word for it. And I think we can move on to a more pleasant question. Let's go to the phones. Here is Mark from Monticello, one of our asparagus question people. Thanks for calling in, Mark. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. First of all, I want to welcome Laura to the program. You're welcome. I'm a long time caller. Well, normally a texter, but I can call in if I can get through really quick. My question is, I have an asparagus bed that's probably like 18 years old, and it's kind of changed. It used to be level with the lawn, but now it's like probably 3 inches lower. And I was considering when the ferns die off this fall, if I could add dirt.
So that you might be burying the crowns a little too deep if you add that. So what I would do once you cut them back, just select just one spot where you can see the stems coming up out of the ground and just see how deep they are going into the soil. Because typically we only bury them. Well, it depends on your soil. If you have a heavier clay based soil, we're usually only burying them about 6 to 8 inches deep. If you have a sandy soil, it's more like 10 to 12 inches. So if you dig down and say you have a more clay heavy soil and from where that low point is, that 3 inches down, if it's 6 to 8 inches further where you see the base of that crown, do not add soil to the top. But, you know, if you dig down, it's 3 or 4 inches and then you get to that little crown piece, then you could definitely top that off with a couple more inches.
Excellent. Thank you, Laura. Thanks for the call, Mark. We have a few other callers on the line, but we do need to take a quick break. So hold on, people. It is 8:20 on WCCO. You're listening to Smart Gardens. It is 8:23 on WCCO Radio. This is Laura Oakes, and this morning for Smart Gardens, I am joined by another Laura, Laura Irish Hansen. She is one of our expert University of Minnesota Extension educators. You can always find more information on anything lawn or garden related on the Extension Services website. That is extension.umn.edu. And Laura, we have another caller on the line with a question. Here's Marlene. Marlene, go ahead.
Hi, welcome, Laura. We enjoy you.
Thank you so much.
We have an old row of old lilacs. Probably there's 8 lilacs, and they're old, but they give them wonderful flowers at last. Anyway, last year they were hit with that powdery mildew. Now, they're better this year. There's a few dead stalks that we're taking out. But I'd heard I should fertilize them. Do I use a really low fertilizer, like a 10-10-10, or what would you suggest?
Yeah, excellent question. This is a pretty prominent powdery mildew on common lilacs. It's just a very common disease pressure. Now, powdery mildew is not typically the reason that you're going to see dieback on your lilacs. It's generally from other stressors like drought stress or some other type of disease pressure, a secondary issue that powdery that you'll see. But most of the time, people just think powdery mildew because it's very visual. So to help your lilacs kind of bounce back, just make sure during those periods where we don't get a lot of precipitation. Generally, most of the summer now, we see long stretches without any rain. Make sure you're watering those older hedges, particularly if you have a sandier soil that dries out quite a bit. I hope you were able to prune out any of those the dead branches. That's the best thing to do. And then if you do think you need to fertilize, I would recommend getting a soil test done first just to determine what's already in the soil. So you might not actually need to be adding a 10-10-10 if there's already excessive phosphorus. That's the second 10 in the 10-10-10 in your soil. So if you do get a soil test, They'll send you the report back pretty quick, and then you'll know, okay, I need to add blank amount of nitrogen. And they are have a pretty comprehensive little summary at the bottom that tells you the best fertilizer to use. But if you can't get your soil tested for some reason, you could do a general fertilizer on those lilacs. Typically, we do that in the spring or late summer.
Super. Thank you for the call, Marlene. You too can be like Marlene and actually call and ask your question instead of texting. I'm looking for some more calls this morning. The number is 651-461-9226. Of course, you can always text your questions in as well, but we love to hear your voice. And I would love to get to know all of you a little bit better here on my first official day. So please give us a call. It is 826 on WCCO. And Laura, here we have another texter talking about apple trees. Should I remove apples from an apple tree planted last year so the nutrients will go to the root system rather than the blossoms?
Yeah, you can definitely do that, particularly if it's a much smaller tree. And some people will buy in trees, you know, and they're pretty large, quite a few years old already. You could probably leave a couple apples on if you are just like, I really would like some apples this year. But yeah, I actually, I grafted my own apples. So very small trees.
Of course you did.
I can't help it. It's fun. And I removed the apples from mine for the first 3 years just to really help those trees, like the texture said, put energy back down into their root system.
All right. Good advice. Another tree question. I have a pine tree that a couple of years ago, the leader branch was trimmed, and now there does not seem to be one. The top of the tree is flat. Will a leader branch eventually come through, or do I need to do something to encourage it? What do you think?
Yeah, topping those pines, it depends on the age too. But generally what happens when we take a strong leader, we cut it off, we do something, it's called breaking apical dominance. The plants naturally are going to want some pretty strong singular main stems, and then we'll get some a little bit of branching below them. So when we take the top off of the tree, generally it'll help initiate new buds to start forming new leaders. And you might actually end up seeing two or three new stems coming up that are going to start competing with one another. And it might take a few years to see that, just depending on the age of the pine, the health of the tree, and that kind of thing. So there's not much you can really do to encourage it to form those new leaders. But I hope you do get some more growth on it.
Super. Patience. Here is a text from Bruce. I moved from southern Minnesota to north of the Brainerd-Baxter area. Can I transplant asparagus from my former garden, which was about 8 years old, to my current one?
Yeah, you should be able to. Asparagus is a pretty hardy perennial plant that we can grow in most portions of the state just fine. I would recommend when you do put it in, we have an asparagus page. Specifically, it's called Growing Asparagus and Home Gardens on our extension.umn.edu. And it perfectly explains how to transplant those plants, best time, what you need to do to make sure that they reestablish. Now, when you do replant them, I would not harvest them next year. So next spring, at a minimum, just because we want to make sure that those plants, as they're going into their new home, are putting energy into that new root system.
Laura, I think I could try some asparagus. This is the first year that I am attempting to grow a few vegetables in a raised planter box. I think I'm doing things right, but this is the first time I've done this, and I'm not real educated on growing vegetables. I am shocked that I am already able to harvest lettuce leaves and eat them in my salads. I just go out and I chop the leaves off, and the next day they're already growing again and almost ready to cut them off again. Is that just how lettuces work?
Yeah, well, there are different types of lettuce.
Okay.
So we have some that are called head lettuces. So think like your iceberg lettuce, romaine lettuce, that generally we wait until they're a little larger. They form a little bit more compact leaves, and then we can chop it off as what we call a head. And then there are loose leaf lettuces. So the ones that you can kind of cut and then come back and let them regrow, depending on how you're growing them. So yeah, totally normal. I like to grow head lettuces, but not treat them as a general head lettuce, and I'll just go and remove the outer leaves just slowly over time, because for me it's a little easier.
Yeah, this is a romaine lettuce, but it has the the nutritional properties of spinach, which I've never seen in my life, but I just love that. And I've been cutting off leaves and eating them almost every day this week. It's been great.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Another text question. This is another lilac question. I planted a new lilac shrub this spring. It just bloomed. Should I remove the spent blooms or should I not prune it since it was recently planted?
You can leave them on there. Generally, that's fine. It's not going to take too much energy away from the plant pushing in those new roots. Just really make sure that you are watering it really well this entire growing season. Anytime we're putting in a particularly new woody plant, so shrubs, trees, we want to make sure that they are getting about an inch of rain a week. And if we're not getting that full inch of rain, we need to make sure that we're going out and watering really thoroughly. So that is more important than removing the spent flowers. Now, if you want to just remove the spent flowers for the aesthetics, go right ahead and do it. It won't hurt the plant.
Great. Another phone call. This is Jean in Eagan. Go ahead, Jean.
Good morning. I have two questions. The first is really quick, but the best time to transplant yarrows. And the second one, though, we've got these Japanese yews that just fared terribly over the winter, and this past winter in particular, and they come up just brown and burnt, and they just never really get green. Some of them get green. They're starting to finally green up now, some of them toward the middle of the summer, but I've never seen them as bad this year, and I'm just wondering if there's something that we can do about that, or do they always become that way over winter?
Yeah, excellent questions. All right, so the yarrow. Yarrow is a really, really resilient plant. So you can kind of grab that crown or dig out that perennial, and you can chop it into multiple pieces and transplant them anytime. Just make sure you're watering it in well and continue watering at least during the hot part of the summer if you're choosing to do it now, just to help those roots fill back into their new space. Now for the yews, and for those who don't know, it's Y-E-W, if you're curious to look that up. For yews, they are susceptible to a couple of things in winter. They are an evergreen, and so they can get, you can think of it like a sunburn in the winter. And so if you haven't already been protecting them with some type of burlap to protect the sun from getting to them, and what ends up happening, well, I can go deep into the science we want, but just think of it as they're trying to photosynthesize. They can't move water because the soil's frozen. And so what ends up happening is the leaves bleach out because chlorophyll can't be produced. Chlorophyll's the green color. And then that's what ends up browning. They can also be susceptible to winter burn, which is from dry winds that can get to them. So protection with burlap can help a lot as you're going into this next late fall into winter. I would recommend pruning out any of those the dead spots that you're seeing. So take your pruners and start shallow. So, you know, go 2 or 3 inches into the stem and cut, and then look at the stem center. If it looks green, leave it alone. It'll push out new growth. If it's brown and looks pretty dry in the center, keep cutting back slowly until you find green stems.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Laura, and thank you for the call, Jean. We appreciate it very much. We are visiting with Laura Irish Hansen. She is a University of Minnesota Extension educator, taking your calls and your texts on any questions you have related to your vegetable garden or your flowers or your lawn or your trees. We love your phone calls, 651-461-9226. That is also the text line if you need to text. It's 8:35 on CCO. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this. It's 8:40 on WCCO. I am Laura Oakes. Thank you for visiting with us this morning and joining us for Smart Gardens. We have Laura Irish Hansen with us from the University of Minnesota Extension Service. Any kind of lawn, garden, flower, plant, vegetable question you have, you can probably find an answer on their beautiful website, extension.umn.edu. And Laura, we have another nice caller on the line this morning. Jennifer, what's your question? Go ahead.
Yes, hi, good morning. First off, thanks for the show. I love it. My question is, I planted a Honeycrisp apple tree and a plum tree several years ago. And I believe didn't choose the best spot because they seem to be dead. The Honeycrisp tree produced little leaves, and they turned black. And I don't know if I can transplant it in the fall and try for a better location. What do you suggest? Thank you so much.
Yeah, so really important for planting those apples and any other fruiting type of trees. Most of them need full sun and well-draining soil, so they shouldn't be anywhere where there's any like pooling or anything like that after major storms. So if that's the issue where they're not getting full sun, they might not produce as well. If they're also in an area where there's not really good airflow, we can see more disease happen for those plants. And so that could be one of the reasons they're turning black. Without seeing the leaves, it's a little hard to diagnose if it is actually a disease or if it's an environmental issue. Now, if the leaves are coming out small, there might just be some environmental pressures happening there where the trees were either too wet or too dry. Either of those are pretty detrimental to apple trees. They also need pretty consistent water to produce fruit and to thrive. So you could move them, and I wouldn't say, we always say fall, but really what that means is late summer. So depending on where you live, you know, that would be mid-August-ish for the northern part of the state to late August to early September for the southern part, just because we want those plants to have at least 4 to 8 weeks to get those root systems started before going into winter. I would recommend trying a different apple variety. Honeycrisp can be a little challenging for homeowners to grow. And so there are some, I call them the babies of Honeycrisp. So they used Honeycrisp in the crosses. So there are some new cultivars that are a little easier for homeowners to grow than Honeycrisp.
Super. Great advice, Laura. Thanks for the call, Jennifer. And I wanted to follow up, Laura, on what you were saying about these fruit trees needing full sun. Technically, and I'm thinking about this for my little raised vegetable garden right now, which is also supposed to have full sun, but I know that there is some shade in the day and you can't have it in sunlight 24 hours a day. So what technically does full sun mean, and how much actual shady, or how many actually shady hours are still okay?
I love this question. I have full slides for this when I go and give presentations. So generally for Minnesota, we have a pretty relatively short growing season compared to much of the rest of the U.S. And so whatever you're doing, make sure you're looking as much as possible for resources from Minnesota or the northern parts of the U.S. if you're looking for information for growing. But full sun, I always consider full sun of 8 direct hours of sunlight during the day. Now, it can be a little less if you're getting blasted with sunlight all afternoon. So say you get full sun from noon to 6 p.m., you can consider that full sun because the afternoon light is just more intense than our morning light. So if you have a little bit of morning light, say from 5:30 when the sun started to come up, right, until like 11, and then you get a couple more hours at the end of the day, you can consider that full sun as well. So it doesn't have to be continuous light in
Good.
Like one block.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Back to the text line. Is it too late to plant cilantro seeds? I'm not finding any plants these days.
Yeah, so cilantro are really prone to what we call bolting, which just means sending up a flower instead of forming the leaves, right? Most of the time, people want to grow cilantro for the leaves rather than letting them bolt, go to flower, and form seed, which we call coriander. So if you do plant cilantro now, I would recommend doing it in a shadier spot, actually, somewhere that stays a little cooler and specifically doesn't get a lot of intense afternoon light, because if it does, it's more likely to bolt much quicker. So make sure you just maintain consistent moisture for wherever you decide to sow them. And then I have put mine in areas that I start cilantro throughout the summer, but when I do that starting now until about end of July, I actually make an artificial cover to block the sun from the west. So I actually put a little shade cloth, just vertically I tie it between two little T-posts so that the plants aren't getting direct sunlight in the afternoon.
Okay, great. Another texter, we put down some native woodland seed mix this fall. I am not seeing much germination yet. Is that normal?
Yeah, it can be. It depends if it's been watered. We've been having really hot, dry in quite a few portions of the state. Yes, we've been getting these random little blips and storms throughout, but they will need pretty consistent moisture. Some of our native species do take a couple years to actually germinate. They need to go through a cold period generally, and we call that a cold dormancy to mimic winter if we're doing it artificially inside. But if you threw out those seeds this spring, a lot of them just might not germinate until next spring because they need to go through a winter period. So I would definitely hold out hope. Make sure you just keep it generally moist and then wait until next spring and see what comes up.
All right. Excellent. It is 847 on WCCO Radio. You're listening to Smart Gardens. If you have a question for our extension educator, Laura Irish Hansen, please call us or give us a text, 651-461-9226. We have some questions lined up regarding an iris, some more tree questions. I have a peony question coming up. Stay with us on WCCO. Josh, I know you're laughing at my yacht rock right now with this.
I'm not laughing. I actually kind of enjoy some of this. I'm younger, stuff. So it's pretty good
yes,
stuff. Yeah,
very good. Thank you. It is 8:51 on WCCO. I'm Laura Oakes. We are visiting with another Laura Irish Hansen. She is a University of Minnesota Extension educator taking all of your calls and questions on lawn and garden and trees and whatever else you might have. And Laura, before we get to a couple more texts, I want to ask you about just the coolest discovery I've been having in my neighborhood lately, and that is I've been seeing a lot of those just those fat, fuzzy little bumblebees, and it just reminded me to ask you just how important our pollinators are and why this is such an important time of year to be mindful of that and try to plant things that'll keep them around and let them do their job. What do we know?
Yeah, so it doesn't feel like spring, at least not the last couple of weeks here. What's really great about a lot of our pollinators, native and non-native pollinators, we do have really warm springs, they might be emerging earlier. And so choosing plants that actually flower earlier to extend our season can be really beneficial for those pollinators. So a lot of us get really excited for all those, you know, summer and fall blooming plants, but I really just want everyone to consider some earlier spring flowering plants that can help those earlier emerging pollinators to thrive.
Excellent. Good. Another texter, could you please review how to care for our iris after they are done blooming?
Yeah, so you can deadhead, which means just removing that flowering stalk, and that can be particularly helpful to help those plants not put energy into potentially forming seeds, depends on what type of iris you have. It'll help put energy into rhizomes. So they're actually compressed stems at the base of the plants that are just at or below the soil surface. And so just remove the flowering heads for that. Now, if you have a clumping iris and you're seeing that the center is kind of dying out, it's a good time once they're done blooming to actually, you can dig those up and divide those plants to give irises more room to grow, so you won't see those dead spots in the center.
Love irises. All right, here's our tree question. Our autumn blaze maple has developed loose bark at its base on the north side of the trunk. The trunk is about 20 inches in diameter. It's about a 20-year-old tree. Is there anything that we need to do for this?
Oh, I wish I had. So what I'm going to recommend the texter does is go on our website and go to the Ask a Master Gardener and submit photos because that'll be really helpful for diagnosing what's going on with your tree, if it's actually an issue or if it's just the natural bark exfoliation. So that is, again, Ask a Master Gardener at extension.umn.edu. Take a few photos. Take a photo of the whole tree so they can get an idea of how large it is and the space, what's going on around the plant. And then also a close-up of that base of what you're seeing.
I hope my little puppy, Shirley, has not been in this person's neighborhood, because she is contributing to the bark exfoliation process. Every time we go on a walk, she takes pretty much two or three big bites out of the base of a tree and wants to carry a little piece of bark in her mouth on our walk. So
it sounds like you need to have sticks in your pocket, Laura.
Yes, we do. It's bark, it's sticks, it's anything at all, and that's fine, and I think it's great. She carries these things around, and she's so proud of them, but I just don't want her to eat them, because then you're picking up poop for 5 hours after your dog walk, and it's just... it's an endless battle with this puppy, but she's adorable. We love her. We're working on it. Anyway, let's move on to peonies. Much more exciting for this show, anyway. Here is somebody with two red charm peonies on either side of a door. In the past, both were very large with lots of flowers, but this year one of them has struggled to come up and is much smaller with only a few stems that droop near tiny buds. Both peonies have been treated the same way. What is going on?
Yeah, so a few things can go on. I'm assuming they're on the other side of, you said a sidewalk. And so there's a lot of compaction that goes on right near the foundation of homes that can be an issue. You might not see it. There could be a drainage issue on the one side where water's actually pooling a little bit more, staying a little wet. And peonies do not do well if they're in too wet of soil. They really need well-draining soil. Another big issue we see is accidentally adding too much mulch. So peonies, those roots should only be about an inch or two below the top of the soil. And so when too much mulch is added over time, they can get buried too deep. And so then they actually will throw out smaller leaves. They'll flower a lot less prolifically, and you'll just see a lot weaker plants over time. So if there is excessive mulch buildup, pull that back and make sure those roots are, again, only about an inch or two below the soil surface. If they're given too much nitrogen, which it doesn't sound like too much nitrogen, but for those who might be seeing this, if you're just not seeing flowering happening for your peonies and you've been fertilizing, you may have actually been giving them too much nitrogen, because nitrogen encourages leafy growth, not flower growth.
Gotcha. Okay, Laura, we need to wrap it up. Why don't you throw out that website one more time for people who need to look up a specific question? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's extension.umn.edu.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much for your beautiful expertise this morning. And again, people, if you'd like to learn more about resilient landscaping and see some beautiful peonies that you really can't see anywhere else, head out to the Arboretum Monday and Tuesday between 10 and 2. It is 8:57 on WCCO Radio. Coming up, it is home improvement time with Andy Lindis from Lindis Construction. We'll be back after the break in Al's News. This is WCCO Moment.